robbed, gorged with blood, and his mouth felt funny, kind of twisted. "My face," he thought, "my face has changed." He sat up. A lantern glowed on the desk nearby. The trailer shuddered under the storm. And suddenly, Friend knelt down in front of him, and a pale, handsome mask with close-cropped blonde hair and ebony eyes peered curiously at him. "Hi there," Friend said with a gentle smile. "Have a nice sleep?"
"I hurt," Roland answered.
The sound of his voice made his skin creep. It had a diseased rattle.
"Oh, I'm sorry.
You've been sleeping for quite some time. We're just a few miles away from that town Brother Timothy told us about. Yes, you really got your beauty sleep, didn't you?"
Roland started to lift his hands to touch his new face, and his heartbeat deafened him.
"Let me," Friend said, and he held up one hand. In it was a broken piece of mirror. Roland saw, and his head jerked away. Friend's other hand shot out, cupping the back of Roland's neck.
"Oh, don't be bashful," the monster whispered. "Take a good long look."
Roland screamed. Internal pressure had buckled the bones into hideous protruding ridges and collapsed gullies. The flesh was sickly yellow, cracked and pitted like an atomic battleground. Red-edged craters had opened in his forehead and his right cheek, exposing the chalky bone. His hair had receded far back on his head and was coarse and white, and his lower jaw jutted forward as if it had been brutally yanked from its sockets. But the most terrible thing, the thing that made Roland begin to wail and gibber, was that his face had been twisted so that it was almost on the side of his head, as if his features had melted and dried hideously askew. In his mouth, the teeth had been ground down to stubs. He flailed at Friend's hand, knocked the glass aside, and scurried into the corner. Friend sat back on his haunches and laughed, while Roland gripped the goggles with both hands and tried to pull them off. The flesh tore around them, and blood ran down to his chin. The pain was too much. The goggles had grown into his skin. Roland shrieked, and Friend shrieked with him in unholy harmony. Finally, Friend snorted and stood up, but Roland grasped his legs and clung to him, sobbing.
"I'm King's Knight," he gibbered. "King's Knight, Sir Roland. King's Knight. King's Knight."
Friend bent down again. The young man was wasted, but he still had talent. He was actually a wonderful organizer of the last gasoline supplies and the food, and he'd made Brother Timothy sing like a castrato. Friend ran a hand through Roland's old man hair.
"King's Knight,"
Roland whispered, burrowing his head into Friend's shoulder. Tumbling through his mind were scenes of Earth House, the amputation of Macklin's hand, the crawl through the tunnel to freedom, the dirtwort land, the murder of Freddie Kempka, and on in a vicious panorama.
"I'll serve you," he whimpered. "I'll serve the king. Call me Sir Roland. Yes, sir, I showed him. I showed him how a king's knight gets even. Yes, sir, yes, sir."
"Shh," Friend said, almost crooning.
"Hush now, hush."
Finally, Roland's sobbing ceased. He spoke drowsily.
Do you love me?"
"Like a mirror," Friend answered, and the young man said no more. The storm slacked off within an hour. The Army of Excellence struggled onward again through the deepening twilight. Soon, the scout jeep came back along the mountain road, and the soldiers reported to General Friend that there were clapboard buildings about a mile ahead. On one of those buildings was a faded sign that read, "Slaty Fork General Store." Chapter 91. They came at first light. Josh was awakened by the banging of a rifle butt on the truck's rear door, and he got up off the metal floor, his bones aching, to move back with Robin and Brother Timothy. The door was unbolted and rolled up on its casters. A blonde man with ebony eyes stood looking in, flanked by two soldiers with rifles. He wore an Army of Excellence uniform with amulets and what appeared to be Nazi medals and insignia on his chest. "Good morning, all," he said cheerfully, and as soon as he spoke, both Josh and Robin knew who he was. "How did we sleep last night?"
"Cold," Josh answered tersely.
"We'll have a heater for you on the plantation, Sambo." His gaze shifted. "Brother Timothy, come out, please." He crooked an inviting finger. Brother Timothy cringed, and the two soldiers came in to haul him out. Josh started to jump one of them, but a rifle barrel was thrust at him, and the moment passed. He saw two jeeps parked nearby, their engines rumbling. In one of them were three people, a driver, Colonel Macklin, and a soldier with a machine gun. In the other was also a driver, another armed soldier, a slumped-over figure wearing a heavy coat and hood, and Swan and Sister, both thin and wan-looking. "Swan!" Robin shouted, stepping toward the opening. She saw him, too, and cried out, "Robin!" As she rose from her seat, the soldier grabbed her arm and pulled her down again. One of the guards shoved Robin back. He rushed at the man, his face contorted with rage, and the soldier lifted his rifle butt to smash Robin's skull. Josh suddenly lunged out and caught the boy, holding him as he thrashed. The soldier spat on the floor, and when he stepped down from the truck, the rear door was slid into place and bolted once more.
"Hey, you bastard!" Josh shouted, peering through one of the 37 punctures. "Hey! I'm talking to you, Creepshow!"
He realized he was bellowing in his old wrestler's voice. Friend shoved Brother Timothy toward the first jeep and then turned regally.
"What do you need Swan and Sister for? Where are you taking them?"
"We're all going up Warwick Mountain to meet God," he answered. "The road's not good enough for anything heavier than the jeeps. That satisfy your old Negroid curiosity?"
"You don't need them. Why don't you leave them here?"
Friend smiled vacantly and strolled closer.
"Oh, they're too valuable for that. Suppose some crafty old fox decided he wanted a little more power and snatched them away while we were gone. That wouldn't do."
He started to return to the jeep.
"Hey, wait,"
Josh called, but the man with the scarlet eye was already getting into the jeep beside Brother Timothy. The two vehicles moved away and out of sight.
"Now what?" Robin asked him, still seething. "Do we just sit here?"
Josh didn't answer. He was thinking of something Brother Timothy had said. The last of the good must die with the evil, must die so the world can be reborn. You must die, and you, and me, and even Swan.
"Swan won't come back," Robin said tonelessly. "Neither will Sister. You know that, don't you?"
"No, I don't."
"He'll pray to the machine that calls down the talons of heaven," he remembered Brother Timothy saying. "Prepare yourselves for the final hour."
"I love her, Josh," Robin said.
He grasped Josh's arm tightly.
"We've got to get out of here. We've got to stop whatever it is that's going to happen."
Josh pulled free. He walked to the far corner of the cell and looked down. On the floor, beside Brother Timothy's bucket, was the tin cup with its sharp metal handle. He picked it up and touched the ragged edge. It was too small and awkward to use as a weapon, and Josh had already dismissed that possibility. But he was thinking of an old wrestling trick, something that was done with a hidden razor when the promoter wanted more juice. It was a common practice, and it always made the violence look more real.
Now, it might give the illusion of something else as well. He started to work. Robin's eyes widened.
What the hell are you doing?
Be quiet, Josh cautioned. Just get ready to start yelling when I say so.
The two jeeps were about a quarter mile away, slowly climbing a winding snow and rain-slick mountain road. At one time, the road had been paved, but the concrete had cracked and slid apart, and underneath was a layer of mud. The jeep's tires slipped, and the vehicles fishtailed as the engines roared for traction. In the second jeep, Sister gripped Swan's hand. The hooded figure, sitting in the front, suddenly turned his head toward them, and they had a heart-stopping glimpse of his deathly yellow cratered face. The goggled eyes lingered on Swan. The drivers fought for every foot. To the right stood a low steel guardrail, and just beyond it was a rocky drop-off that fell 70 feet into a wooded ravine. Still, the road ascended as the broken plates of concrete shifted beneath the jeep's wheels. The road curved to the left and was blocked by an 8-foot-high chain-link fence and gate. On the gate was a metal sign, surprisingly free of corrosion. Warwick Coal Mining Company. Trespassers will be prosecuted. 10 feet beyond the fence was a brick enclosure where a guard might once have stood duty. A sturdy-looking chain and padlock secured the gate, and Friend said, "Get that thing open," to the soldier with the machine gun. The man got out, walked to the gate, and reached out to test the padlock before he blasted it off. There was a sizzling like fat being fried in a pan. The soldier's legs began to boogie, with his hand sealed to the chain and his face bleached and grimacing. The machine gun chattered on its own, spraying bullets into the ground. His clothes and hair smoked, his face taking on a blue cast. Then the muscle tension snapped the soldier backward and he fell, still jerking and writhing, to the ground. The smell of scorched flesh and electricity wafted through the air. Friend whirled around and clamped his hand to Brother Timothy's throat. "Why didn't you say it was an electric fence?" he bellowed.
I didn't know. It was broken open the last time. God must have fixed it.
Friend almost set him afire, but he could see that Brother Timothy was telling the truth. The electrified fence also told him that the power source, wherever it was still active. He released the man, got out of the jeep, and strode to the gate. He reached through the chain-link mesh and grasped the padlock. His fingers worked at it, trying to break it open. Both Swan and Sister saw his sleeve beginning to smoke, the flesh of his hand getting as soft as used chewing gum. The padlock resisted him, and he could feel the little bitch watching and sucking all the strength out of him. In a rage, he gripped the mesh with the fingers of both hands and wrenched at the gate like a child trying to break into a locked playground. Sparks popped and flew. For an instant, he was outlined in an electric blue glow, his Army of Excellence uniform smoking and charring, the shoulder epaulets bursting into flame. Then the gate's hinges gave way, and Friend hurled the gate aside.
"Didn't think I could, did you?"
he shouted at Swan. His face had gone waxy, most of his hair and his eyebrows singed away. Her expression remained placid, and he knew it was a good thing she was going to a prison camp, because the bitch would have to be broken under a whip before she learned respect. He had to concentrate harder than usual to get his oozing hands solid again. His epaulets were still burning, and he tore them away before he retrieved the dead soldier's machine gun and returned to the first jeep. "Let's go," he ordered. Two fingers on his right hand remained scorched and twisted, and they would not reform. The two jeeps moved through the opening and continued up the mountain road, winding between dense stands of lifeless pines and hardwood trees. They came to a second brick guard station, where a rusted sign commanded, "Present identification." Atop the structure was what appeared to be a small videotape camera.
"They had pretty tight security up here for a coal mine," Sister observed, and Roland Croninger growled,
"No talking."
The road emerged from the forest into a clearing. There was a paved parking lot, empty of cars, and beyond it stood a complex of one-story brick buildings and a larger aluminum-roofed structure built right into the mountainside. Warwick Mountain continued upward about another 200 feet, covered with dead trees and boulders, and at its peak, Sister saw three rusted towers, antennas, she realized, that disappeared in the swirling gray clouds.
"Stop," Friend said. The driver obeyed, and a second later, the other jeep halted.
He sat looking around the complex for a moment, his eyes narrowed and his senses questing. There was no movement, no life as far as he could see. The chilly wind blew across the parking lot and thunder rumbled in the clouds. A black drizzle began to fall again. Friend said,
"Get out," to Brother Timothy.
"What?"
"Get out," Friend repeated. "Walk ahead of us and start calling him. Go on."
Brother Timothy climbed out of the jeep and started walking across the parking lot through the black rain.
"God,"
he shouted, and his voice echoed off the walls of the large metal-roofed building.
"It's Timothy. I've come back to you."
Friend got out and followed behind him a few yards, the machine gun resting on his hip.
"God, where are you? I've come back."
"Keep going,"
Friend told him, and the other man walked forward with the rain beating in his face. Sister had been waiting for the right moment. Everyone's attention was fixed on the two men. The woods lay about 30 yards away, and if she could keep the rest of them busy, Swan might have a chance to make it. They wouldn't kill her. And if she could reach the woods, Swan might be able to escape. She squeezed Swan's hand, whispered,
"Get ready,"
and tensed to slam her fist into the face of the guard at her side. Brother Timothy shouted joyously,
"There he is!"
She looked up. High above, a figure stood on the sloping aluminum roof. Brother Timothy fell to his knees, his hands upraised and his face torn between terror and rapture.
"God," he called, "it's the final hour. Evil's won. Cleanse the world, God. Call down the talons of heaven."
Machine gun bullets ripped across his back. He fell forward, his body still kneeling in an attitude of prayer. Friend swung the smoking barrel up toward the roof.
"Come down," he ordered.
The figure stood motionlessly, but for the billowing of a long ragged coat around his thin body.
"I'll tell you once more," Friend warned, "and then we'll see what color God's blood is."
Still the figure hesitated. Swan thought the man with the scarlet eye was going to shoot, but then the figure on the roof walked over near the edge, lifted a hatch, and began to descend a metal-runged ladder bolted to the building's wall. He reached the ground and walked to Brother Timothy, where he bent to examine the dead man's features. Friend heard him mutter something, and God shook his gray-maned head in disgust. Then he stood up again, approached Friend, and stopped about 2 feet away. Above the dirty, tangled mat of his gray beard, the man's eyes were sunken deep in purple craters, his flesh ivory and covered with intersecting cracks and wrinkles. A brown ridged scar sliced across his right cheek, narrowly missing the eye, cutting through the thick eyebrow and up into the hairline, where it divided into a network of scars. His left hand, dangling from the folds of his overcoat, was brown and withered to the size of a child's. "You bastard," he said, and with his right hand, he slapped Friend across the face.
"Help!"
Robin Oakes was shouting.
"Somebody help! He's killing himself!"
Sergeant Shitpants emerged from a nearby trailer, cocked his .45 automatic, and ran through the rain to the truck. Another guard with a rifle came from a different direction, and a third soldier followed.
"Hurry!"
Robin yelled frantically, looking through one of the punctures.
"Somebody help him!"
Sergeant Shitpants thrust the pistol's barrel up at Robin's face. "What's going on?"
"It's Josh. He's trying to kill himself. Open the door."
"Right. Fuck that."
"He's cut his wrist, you dumbass," Robin told him. "He's bleeding all over the floor in here."
"Yeah, that trick was old in silent movies, you little prick." Robin pushed three fingers through one of the holes, and Sergeant Shitpants saw the crimson smear of blood all over them.
"He slashed his wrists with a cop handle," Robin said. "If you don't help him, he's going to bleed to death."
"Let the nigger die, then," the guard with the rifle said.
"Shut up."
Sergeant Shitpants was trying to figure out what he should do. He knew the consequences if anything happened to the prisoners. Colonel Macklin and Captain Croninger were bad enough. But the new commander would cut off his balls and use them as hood ornaments.
"Help him!"
Robin shouted.
"Don't just stand there!"
"Right, step back from the door," the other man ordered.
"Go on, get back! And if you make one move I don't like, I swear to God you're dead meat."
Robin retreated. The door was unbolted and shoved upward about 8 inches.
"Throw it out! The cop, throw that damn thing out!"
A bloody tin cup was slid through the opening. The sergeant picked it up, felt the ragged metal edge, and tasted the blood to make sure it was real. It was.
"Damn it!"
he raged, and he pushed the door up the rest of the way. Robin stood at the back of the truck, away from the door. Curled on the floor near him was the body of Josh Hutchins, lying on his right side with his face averted. Sergeant Shitpants climbed into the truck, his gun aimed at Robin's head. The guard with a rifle climbed up as well, and the third man stayed on the ground with his pistol unholstered and ready.
"Stay back and keep both hands up," Sergeant Shitpants warned Robin as he approached the black man's body.
Blood gleamed on the floor. The sergeant saw blood all over the black man's clothes, and he reached down to touch one outthrust wrist. His own fingers came away bloody.
"Jesus," he said, realizing he was tailbone deep in trouble.
He holstered his .45 and tried to turn the man over, but Josh was way too heavy for him.
"Help me move him," he told Robin.
And the boy bent down to grasp Josh's other arm. Josh gave a low, guttural groan. And two things happened at once. Robin picked up the bucket of waste lying beside Josh's arm and hurled its contents into the face of the guard with a rifle, and Josh's body came to life, his right fist smashing into Sergeant Shitpants' jaw and snapping it crooked. The man gave a scream as his teeth tore into his tongue, and then Josh was wrenching the .45 out of its holster. The blinded guard fired his rifle, but the bullet sang past Robin's head as the boy lunged at him, grabbing the rifle and kicking him in the groin. The third soldier fired at Josh, but the bullet hit Sergeant Shitpants in the back and drove him into Josh like a shield. Josh wiped the blood out of his eyes and shot at the soldier, but the man was already running through the rain shouting for help. Robin kicked the guard again, tumbling him out of the truck to the ground. Josh knew they would only have a minute or so before the place was swarming with soldiers, and he started digging through Sergeant Shitpants' pockets, looking for the truck's key. Blood was streaming down his face from three slashes across his forehead, inflicted with the ragged edge of the metal. He'd smeared his wrist with blood and gotten it all over his clothes to make it appear as if he'd cut his veins. In the wrestling ring, a small sliver of razor blade hidden in a bandage had often been drawn across the forehead to create a superficial but nasty-looking wound, and in this case, the gore was needed for a similarly theatrical purpose. Two soldiers were running toward the truck. Robin took aim and shot one of them down, but the other fell onto his stomach and crawled under a trailer. Josh couldn't find a key.
"Look in the ignition," he shouted, and he fired shots at random as Robin jumped to the ground and ran around to the truck's cab.
He opened the door and reached up to the dashboard, his fingers searching. There was no key in the ignition. The soldier under the trailer squeezed off two shots that ricocheted dangerously around Josh, who flung himself flat. Another soldier opened up with an automatic rifle over to the left. The air turned hot above Josh's head, and he heard bullets whack off the inside of the truck like hammers beating garbage can lids. Robin searched under the seat and found nothing but empty cartridges. He opened the glove compartment. There! Inside was a tarnished key and a snub-nosed .38. He fit the key into the ignition, turned it, and jammed his foot down on the accelerator. The engine coughed and racketed, then roared to life, the entire truck quaking. He gaped at the gear shift. Shit, he thought. One thing he'd forgotten to tell Josh while they were planning their escape was that his experience in driving had been very limited. Still, he knew you had to press the clutch down to engage the gears. He did, and he forced the gear shift into first over the transmission's objections. Then he put his foot to the floor on the accelerator and let up suddenly on the clutch. The truck shot forward as if it were rocket-powered. Josh was propelled to the edge of the truck's bed, and he kept himself from flying out by grabbing the upraised track of metal on which the door slid up and down. Robin jammed the gear shift into second. The truck bucked like a wild stallion as it tore through the encampment, grazing a parked car and scattering a half-dozen soldiers who had been alerted by the noise. A bullet shattered the windshield and sent wasps of glass flying around Robin's head and face. But he shielded his eyes and kept going. Robin shifted upward as the truck gained speed. Glass glittered in his tangled hair like wet diamonds. He reached over for the .38, popped its cylinder open, and found it held four bullets. He veered past another parked vehicle, almost crashed into a trailer, and then the truck was out on the open road, speeding away from the camp. Just ahead was the turnoff to the right that Robin knew must lead up the side of Warwick Mountain. He could see the tracks of the Jeep's tires in the mud as he slowed the truck enough to take the sharp turn. In the rear of the truck, Josh lost his grip and was battered against the opposite wall with bone-jarring force, and it occurred to him that this was surely going to be a day to remember. But they had to reach Sister and Swan before the final hour, whatever and whenever that was. Robin was driving like hell up the mountain road, the tires skidding back and forth, the truck careening from one side of the road to the other. Josh hung on as best he could, and he saw sparks fly as the truck grazed the right-hand guardrail. A plate of concrete suddenly slipped out from under the rear tires, and the wheel tore itself from Robin's hands. The truck hurtled toward the cliff's edge. He threw all his weight against the wheel to twist it around, his foot fighting the brake. The tires threw up plumes of mud, and the front fender dented the guardrail about 6 inches before the truck came to a stop. Then he felt the tires starting to slide back over the broken concrete, mud, and snow. He pulled up the emergency brake, but there was no traction to lock the tires. The truck slid in reverse, quickly gathering speed as Robin tried to jam the gear shift into first again, but he knew it was the end of the line. He opened the door, shouted, "Jump!" and did so. Josh didn't wait to be told twice. He jumped from the rear of the truck, hit the mud, and rolled aside as the vehicle fishtailed past him. It kept going, the front of the truck sliding around as if the vehicle was trying to spin in a circle. And then a Jeep, carrying five Army of Excellence soldiers, suddenly veered around the curve, heading uphill and going too fast to stop. Josh saw the expression of stark terror on the driver's face. The soldier instinctively threw up his arms as if to hold back metal with muscle and bone. The runaway truck and the Jeep crashed together, and the truck's weight shoved the smaller vehicle through the guardrail and followed it over the cliff's edge like an anvil. Josh looked over the rail in time to see human bodies tumbling through space. There was a chorus of high screams, and then the bodies disappeared in the ravine. And either the Jeep or truck exploded in a burst of flame and black smoke. Josh and Robin had no time to ponder how close they'd come to taking a one-way flight. Josh still gripped the automatic in his hand, and Robin had the .38 with four bullets in it. They would have to go the rest of the way on foot, and they had to hurry. Josh took the lead, his boots skidding over the tortured surface, and Robin followed him upward toward the realm of God. Chapter 92. In the aftermath of the slap, Friend curled his hand into the man's collar, drawing him close. God wore the dirty rags of a blue-checked shirt and khaki trousers under his coat. On his feet were leather moccasins, and he wore emerald-green socks. Sister realized that the unkempt, wild-eyed man would have fit right in among the street people of Manhattan before the 17th of July.
I could hurt you, Friend whispered. Oh, you don't know how I could hurt.
The man gathered a mouthful of saliva and spat in Friend's waxy face. Friend threw him to the ground and kicked him in the ribs. The man curled up, trying to protect himself, but Friend kept kicking him in a frenzy. He grasped God by the hair and slammed his fist into the man's face, breaking his nose and splitting his lower lip open. Then he hauled God up again and held him for the others to see.
Look at him, Friend crowed. Here's your God. He's a crazy old man who's got shit for brains. Go on, look at him.
He grasped the man's beard and angled his bloody face toward Swan and Sister.
He's nothing.
And as emphasis, Friend drove his fist deep into the man's belly, but held him upright even as his knees buckled. Friend started to strike him again, and a calm, clear voice said, Leave him alone. Friend hesitated. Swan was standing up in the second jeep, the rain running through her hair and across her face. She couldn't bear to watch the old man being beaten, and she couldn't sit in silence.
Let him go, she said,
and the man with the scarlet eye grinned incredulously.
You heard me. Take your hand off him.
I'll do as I please, he roared,
and he laid his fingers alongside the man's cheek. His nails began to tear through the skin.
I'll kill him if I want. No, Roland protested. Don't kill him. I mean, we've got to find the black box and the silver key. That's what we came here for. Then you can kill him. You don't tell me what to do, Friend shouted. It's my party.
He shot a challenging glare at Colonel Macklin, who did nothing but sit and stare blankly ahead. Then Friend's gaze met Swan's and their eyes locked. For a second, he thought he could see himself through her unflinching eyes, an ugly, hateful thing, a small face hidden behind an oversized Halloween mask like a cancer under gauze. She knows me, he thought. That fact made him afraid, just as he'd feared the glass ring when it went black in his grip. And something else speared him, too. The memory of the offered apple and his desire to accept it.
Too late. Too late.
He saw, just for an instant, who and what he was. And in that brief space of time, he knew himself, too, in a way that he'd shoved aside a long, long time before. Self-loathing uncoiled within him. And suddenly he feared that he was going to see too much, and he would start to split at the seams, unravel like an old suit, and blow away in the wind.
Don't look at me!
He screamed, his voice shrill, and he lifted one hand to shield his face from hers. Behind his hand, his features churned like muddy water disturbed by a stone. He could still feel her there, drawing the strength out of him like the sunlight drawing the wet from rotten timber. He flung God to the ground, backed away, and kept his face averted. Now the truth was coming back to him. It was not himself he should loathe. It was her. She was the ruin and enemy of all creation because she... Too late, too late, he thought, still backing away, because she wanted to prolong the suffering and misery of humankind. She wanted to give them false hope and watch them writhe when it was wrenched away. She was too late.
Too late.
The worst kind of evil. Because she masked cruelty with kindness and love with hate. And too late. Too late.
Too late, he whispered,
and he lowered his hand. He'd stopped retreating, and he realized then that Swan had gotten out of the jeep and was standing over the gray-bearded old man. He saw the others watching, and he caught a thin, mocking smile on Macklin's skull of a face.
Stand up, Swan told the old man.
Her spine was rigid, her bearing proud, but inside her nerves were knotted with tension. God blinked at her, wiped the blood from his nostrils, and looked fearfully at the man who'd struck him.
It's all right, Swan said, and she offered him her hand.
She's just a girl, Friend realized. She's not even worth a rape. And she'd like me to rape her, too. She'd like me to stick it in hard and grind up to my ankles.
God hesitated uncertainly, and then he put his hand into Swan's.
I'll rape her, Friend decided. I'll show her it's still my party. I'll show her right fucking now.
He advanced on her like a juggernaut, and every step he took made his crotch bulge larger. He was leering, and she saw that leer and knew what was behind it, and she waited for him without moving.
The hollow, booming echo of an explosion drifted from the distance.
Friend stopped in his tracks.
What was that?
He shouted to everyone and no one.
What was that?
Came from the road, one of the soldiers said.
Well, don't sit there. Get off your ass and find out what it was. All of you, go!
The three soldiers left the jeeps and ran across the parking lot. They disappeared around the heavily wooded bend, their weapons ready. But Friend's weapon was shriveling. He couldn't look at the bitch without thinking of the apple. And he knew she'd planted some kind of evil, soul-destroying seed right in him, too. But it was still his party, and it was too late for turning back, and he would rape her and crush her skull when she was 80 years old and her fingers were worked to the bones. But not today. Not today. He aimed his machine gun at Sister.
Get out. You stand over there with a little bitch.
Swan let her breath out. His attention was on other things now, but he was still as dangerous as a mad dog in a butcher's shop. She helped the old man to his feet. He staggered, still hurting from the blow that had shattered his nose, and looked around at the malformed faces of Macklin and Roland.
It is the final hour, isn't it?
He asked Swan.
Evil's won. It's time for the final prayer, isn't it?
She couldn't answer. He touched her cheek with spavined fingers.
Child, what's your name?
Swan, he repeated it.
So young, he said sadly. So young to have to die.
Roland got out of his jeep, but Macklin stayed where he was. His shoulders stooped now that Friend was in control again.
Who are you? Roland asked the old man. What are you doing up here?
I'm God. I fell to earth from heaven. We landed in water. The other one lived for a while, but I couldn't heal him. Then I found my way here because I know this place.
What's your power source?
God extended a finger and pointed to the earth at his feet.
Underground?
Roland asked.
Where? In the coal mine.
God didn't reply, but instead lifted his face toward the sky and let the rain beat down. Roland drew his pistol from the holster at his waist, cocked it, and placed it to the man's head.
You answer when I ask you a question, you old fuck. Where's that power coming from?
The man's insane eyes met Roland's.
All right, he said, and he nodded. A-okay. I'll show you, if you want to see. We do.
I'm sorry, child, he told Swan. Evil's won, and it's time for the final prayer. You do understand, don't you?
Evil hasn't won. Not everybody is like they are.
It's the final hour, child.
I fell from heaven in a whirlwind of fire. I knew what had to be done, but I waited. I couldn't make myself pray the last prayer. But now I can, because I see that the world has to be cleansed,
he said to the others.
Follow me.
And he started walking toward the large building with the metal roof.
Colonel, Friend prompted, we're waiting for you.
I'll stay here.
You'll come with us.
Friend swung the machine gun's barrel up at him.
Roland, take the colonel's pistol away from him, please.
Yes, sir.
Roland answered at once, and he approached Macklin.
He held out his hand for the other man's weapon. Colonel Macklin didn't move. The rain was falling harder, hammering on the jeeps and streaming down Macklin's face.
"Roland,"
Macklin said in a strengthless voice,
"we created the Army of Excellence together, both of us. We're the ones who make plans for the new America, not that thing over there."
He motioned toward Friend with his nail-studded right hand.
"He just wants to destroy it all. He doesn't care about the Army of Excellence, or the new America, or feeding the troops. He doesn't care about the girl. All he wants to do is put her on that prison farm out of his way. And he doesn't care about you either. Roland, please, don't follow him. Don't do what he says."
He reached out to touch Roland, but the young man stepped back.
"Roland, I'm afraid,"
Macklin whispered.
"Give me a gun."
In that moment, Roland despised the cringing dog who sat before him. He'd seen that weakness before, back when Macklin was delirious after his hand had been amputated. But now, Roland knew the weakness went soul deep. Macklin had never been a king, only a coward hiding behind a warrior's mask. Roland pressed the barrel of his own weapon against the colonel's head.
"Give me your gun," he repeated. "Please, think about what we've been through. You and me, together."
"I have a new king now," Roland said flatly. He looked at Friend. "Should I kill him?"
"If you like."
Roland's finger tightened on the trigger. Macklin knew death was very near, and its oily perfume energized him to action. His spine stiffened, and he sat up ramrod straight.
"Who do you think you are?"
he said vehemently.
"You're nothing. I was fighting for my life in a Viet Cong POW camp when you were shitting your diapers. I'm Colonel James B. Macklin, United States Air Force. I fought for my life and for my country, boy. Now you get that fucking gun away from my head."
Roland faltered.
"Did you hear what I said, mister? If you want my weapon, you ask for it with the respect I deserve."
Every muscle in his body tightened as he waited for the gun to go off. Still, Roland didn't move. Friend laughed quietly, and God was waiting for them about 10 yards beyond Swan and Sister. Slowly, Roland took the pistol away from Macklin's head.
"Give me your gun,
sir,"
he said. Macklin removed it from his holster and flung it to the ground. And then he stood up and got out of the jeep, but unhurriedly, at his own pace.
"Let's go, kiddies,"
Friend said. He motioned toward Swan and Sister with a machine gun, and they followed God to the metal-roofed building. Inside, it was apparent that the building was nothing more than a huge shed protecting the entrance to the Warwick Mountain coal mine. The floor was of hard-packed dirt, and a few naked light bulbs that hung from the ceiling gave off a dirty yellow illumination. Bundles of cables and wires lay around, as well as old pieces of steel track. Piles of rotting timber and other bits of refuse that suggested Warwick Mountain had once boasted a thriving coal business. A steel stairway ascended to a series of catwalks, and at the far end of the building where the structure abutted Warwick Mountain was the dark square of the mine's entrance. God led them up the stairway and along one of the catwalks to the mine shaft. A few light bulbs gave off a meager yellow glow within the mine, which slanted downward at a deep angle. Resting on tracks inside the shaft was a large wire mesh cage about 6 feet high and 4 feet wide, its wheels like those of a railroad car. Inside it were padded benches and straps to hold the riders in place. God opened the rear of the cage and waited for them to enter it.
"I'm not getting in that damned thing," Sister balked. "Where are you taking us?"
"Down there." God pointed along the mine shaft, and the yellow light winked off something metallic in the sleeve of his blue checked shirt.
Sister realized the old man was wearing cufflinks. He looked at Friend.
"Isn't that where you want to go?"
"What's in there?"
Roland asked, all his bluff and bluster gone.
"The power source you're looking for, and other things you might be interested in seeing. Do you want to go or not?"
"You get in first," Friend told him.
"A-okay."
God turned toward the rock wall, where there was a panel with two buttons on it, one red and the other green. He punched the green button, and the sound of humming machinery echoed up the shaft. Then he climbed into the cage, sat down on one of the benches, and buckled himself in.
"All aboard," he said cheerfully. "We'll start moving in 10 seconds.
Friend was the last one in. He crouched at the rear of the cage, his face averted from Swan's. The machinery got steadily louder, and then there were 4 clicks as the brakes on each wheel disengaged. The cage began to descend along the tracks, its speed restrained by a steel cable that had snapped taut and was reeling out behind it.
"We're going down more than 300 feet, God explained. "This used to be a working mine about 30 years ago. Then the United States government bought it. Of course, all this rock is reinforced with concrete and steel."
He waved his arm at the walls and roof, and Sister saw the cufflink glitter again. Only this time, she was close enough to see that it looked very familiar and it had writing on it.
"You'd be amazed to know what the engineers can do," he continued. "They put in ventilation ducts and air pumps, and even the light bulbs are supposed to last for 7 or 8 years. But they're starting to burn out now. Some of the same people who put this place together worked on Disney World."
Sister caught his sleeve and looked closer at the cufflink. On it was a very recognizable blue, white, and gold emblem, and the much-polished lettering said, "Seal of the President of the United States of America." Her fingers had gone numb, and she let his arm go. He stared impassively at her.
"What's down in here?" she asked him.
"Talons," he said. "The talons of heaven."
They went through a long area where there were burned-out light bulbs, and when they approached the illumination again, the president's eyes burned with inner fever as he stared across the cage at Friend.
"You want to see a power source?" he asked, his breath wisping out in the chilly air. "You will, oh yes. I promise you will."
In another minute, the brakes engaged again and shrieked along the tracks as the conveyance shuddered and slowed. It bumped against a thick foam rubber barrier and stopped. The president unbuckled his seat belt, opened the front section of the cage, and stepped out.
"This way," he said, motioning them on like a demented tour guide.
Roland shoved Swan ahead of him, and they entered a passageway that led off to the right of the tracks. Bulbs burned fitfully overhead, and suddenly the passageway ended at a wall of rough-edged rocks.
"It's blocked," Roland said. "It's a dead end."
But Friend shook his head. He'd already seen the small black box embedded in the rock wall at about chest height. The upper half of the black box seemed to be some sort of display screen, while the bottom was a keyboard. The president reached up to his throat with his good hand and lifted off a braided length of leather that had been hanging around his neck. On it were several keys, and the president chose one that was small and silver. He kissed it, and then he started to insert it into a lock in the black box.
"Hold it," Friend said. "What does that thing do?"
"It opens the door," the man replied. He fit the key into the lock and twisted it to the left.
Instantly, pale green letters appeared on the screen. "Hello. Enter code within 5 seconds." Swan and Sister watched as the president punched 3 letters on the keyboard. A-O-K. "Code accepted," the screen replied. "Have a nice day." Electric tumblers whirred, and there was the muffled sound of locks opening in rapid-fire succession. The false wall of rock cracked open like the door of a massive vault, hissing on hydraulic hinges. The president pulled it wide enough to admit them, and clean white light glowed from the room beyond.
Roland started to reach up for the silver key, but the old man said, "No, leave that alone. If it's disturbed while the door's open, the floor's electrified." Roland's fingers stopped an inch away from the key.
"You go first."
Friend shoved the man through the opening. Sister and Swan were pushed in. Macklin followed, then Roland, and finally the man with the scarlet eye. They all squinted in the bright light of a white-walled, antiseptic-looking chamber where six mainframe computers quietly conversed, their data tapes slowly turning behind windows of tinted glass. The floor was coated with black rubber, and there was the polite rumble of the air purifying system drawing cleansed air through small metal grills in the walls. At the center of the room, sitting atop a rubber-coated table and connected by thick bundles of cables to the mainframe computers, was another small black box with a keyboard about the size of a telephone. Roland was delirious at the sight of the machines. It had been so long since he'd seen a computer, he'd forgotten how beautiful they were. To him, the mainframes were the Ferraris of computers, pulsing brain matter squished into sleek plastic and metal skins. He could almost hear them breathing. "Welcome to my home," the president said, and then he walked to a metal panel on the wall. There was a small lever that you could fit your finger into and pull upward on, and above it, a little red plastic danger sign. He hooked his finger into the lever's notch and wrenched it up. The door slammed shut, and instantly the electronic locks bolted themselves. On this side of the false wall was a sheet of stainless steel. Swan and Sister had turned to face him. Friend had his finger on the machine gun's trigger, and Macklin stood staring numbly at the old man. "There," the president said. "There." He stepped back from the metal panel, nodding with satisfaction.
"Open that door,"
Macklin demanded, his flesh crawling. The walls were closing in on him, and this place was too much like Earth House.
"I don't like to be shut up. Get that damn door open."
"It's locked," the other man replied.
"Open it,"
Macklin shouted. "Please open it," Swan said. The president shook his gray-maned head.
"I'm sorry, child. Once you lock the door from in here, it's locked for good. I lied about the key. I just didn't want him to pull it out. See, you can open it from the inside if you have the silver key. But now the computer's locked it, and there's no way out."
"Why?" Sister asked, her eyes wide. "Why'd you lock us in here?"
"Because we're going to stay here until we die. The talons of heaven are going to destroy all the evil, every bit of it. The world will be cleansed and the world can begin again, fresh and new, you see."
Colonel Macklin attacked the stainless steel door, hammering at it with his good hand. The insulation in the room soaked up the noise like a sponge, and Macklin couldn't even put a dent in the steel. The door had no handles, nothing to grab hold of. He turned on the old man and charged at him with his deadly right hand upraised for a killing blow. But before Macklin reached him, Friend stopped the colonel with a short, sharp blow to the throat. Macklin gagged and fell to his knees, his eyes bright with terror.
"No,"
Friend said, like an adult chastising a naughty child. Then he lifted his gaze to the old man.
"What is this place? What are these machines for, and where's the power coming from?"
"Those gather information from satellites," the president motioned toward the mainframes.
"I know what space looks like. I've looked down on the Earth. I used to believe it was such a good place."
He blinked slowly as the memory of falling through the flaming whirlwind again stirred like a recurrent nightmare.
"I fell to Earth from heaven. Yes, I fell, and I came here, because I knew I was close to this place. There were two men here, but they're not here now. They had food and water enough to last them for years. I think one of them died. I don't know what happened to the other one. He just went away."
He paused for a moment, and then his mind cleared again.
He stared at the black box on the rubber-coated table and approached it reverently.
"This," he said, "will bring down the talons of heaven." "The talons of heaven. What's that mean?"
"Talons," the president said, as if the other man should know.
"Tactical long-range nuclear sanitizer. Watch and listen."
He punched his code into the keyboard. A-OK. The mainframes began to spin their data tapes faster. Roland watched, fascinated. A woman's voice, soft and seductive, as cool as balm on an open wound, filtered through the speakers in the walls.
"Hello, Mr. President. I'm waiting for your instructions."
The voice reminded Sister of a New York social worker who'd politely explained that there was no more room in the woman's shelter on a freezing January night. The president typed, "Here is Belladonna, the Lady of the Rocks, the Lady of Situations.
Here is the man with three staves, and here the wheel,"
the disembodied computer voice answered.
"Whoa,"
Roland breathed. "And here is the one-eyed merchant and his card,
which is blank, is something he carries on his back,"
the president typed, "which I am forbidden to see."
"What are you doing?"
Sister shouted, close to panic. Swan squeezed her hand. "I do not find the hanged man," the president typed into the black box.
"Fear death by water,"
the feminine voice replied. There was a pause, then,
"Talons armed, sir. 10 seconds to abort."
He pressed two letters in the keyboard. "No."
"Initial abort sequence denied. Talons firing procedure activated, sir."
The voice was as cool as the memory of lemonade on a scorching August afternoon.
"Talons will be in target range in 13 minutes and 48 seconds.
Then the computer voice was silent.
"What's happened?"
Friend was keenly interested.
"What'd you do?"
"In 13 minutes and 48 seconds, the president said, "two satellites will enter the atmosphere over the North Pole and Antarctica. Those satellites are nuclear missile platforms that will each fire 30 25-megaton warheads into the ice caps."
He glanced over at Swan and looked quickly away because her beauty made him yearn.
"The blasts will throw the Earth off its axis and melt the ice. The world will be cleansed, don't you see? All the evil will be washed away by the talons of heaven, and someday things will start over again, and they'll be good, like they used to be."
His face wrinkled with pain.
"We lost the war," he said. "We lost. And now we have to start all over again."
"Ah, doomsday machine,"
Friend whispered, and a grin skittered across his mouth. The grin stretched into a laugh, and the eyes danced with malignant glee.
"A doomsday machine," he shouted. "Oh, yes! The world must be cleansed. All the evil must be washed away, like her."
He pointed a finger at Swan.
"The last of the good must die with the evil," the president replied. "Must die, so the world can be reborn."
"No, no,"
Macklin croaked, clutching at his bruised throat. Friend laughed, and he directed his attention to Sister, though he really spoke to Swan.
"I told you," he crowed. "I told you I'd make a human hand do the work."
The cool feminine voice said,
13 minutes to detonation."
Chapter 93. Josh and Robin came upon the dead soldier at the broken open gate, and Josh bent down beside the corpse. Robin heard a hissing, sputtering noise, but couldn't figure out where it was coming from. He reached out to touch the chain-link fence.
"No!"
Josh said sharply, and Robin's fingers stopped just short of the metal mesh.
"Look at this.
Josh opened the dead man's right hand, and Robin could see the chain-link design burned into the corpse's flesh.